Good morning, everyone. We begin in the Middle East, and I was thinking over the weekend, on the road to Damascus, St. Paul had that vision.
Right.
And made his celebrated conversion to,
right.
I don't even think it was called Christianity at the time, but it started the Christian movement. Did he have any idea how significant that conversion on the road to Damascus would be?
No, although his retelling of the story is significantly dramatic.
Indeed. Well, in Damascus today, while there may not be the same kind of history at play, it certainly constitutes a linchpin of the ossified Arab leadership generation that seems to be inflamed with revolution from North Africa straight through to the Middle East. And would revolutionary change in Syria mean a real change in direction for this so-called Arab awakening that we're viewing? Syria has connections to and control of territory in Lebanon. It has longstanding ties to Iran. So a reshuffling of the government in Syria, in Damascus, would mean change on a number of levels and force a reexamination of lots of policies around the world. Any conversions likely on the road to Damascus in 2011? We've asked to join us once again Joshua Landis, who's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning to you.
So let's begin with the news of the morning out of Syria. They're talking about possibly lifting a 50-year-old emergency law that's been in place. I can't remember what the event might have been.
1963, when the Ba'ath Party took over.
There we go. So the emergency law has been in place for 50 years, but now that there's fighting in the streets, they're going to remove the emergency law? It seems a slight reverse of reality here.
Your skepticism is, I think, well-founded. There are many laws in Syria. The emergency law was imposed in 1963 when there was a coup d'etat and the Ba'ath Party took over. It was used to abrogate the Constitution, which in Syria is quite good. It gives you the right to assembly, the right to free press and opinions and so forth. But in the meantime, many new laws have been imposed, and one of the things the government said they were going to do is to adumbrate an anti-terrorism law. So it would allow, one can assume, the government to still take these sort of emergency actions.
I guess the scenario we're seeing here reminds one a little bit of what happened in Egypt, which, of course, had a constitution with all kinds of flowery language about freedom and rights for people and citizens being able to confront their government. But is the government of Syria able to play this game of offering some reforms while still staying in power and stay out in front of the unrest that we're seeing week to week?
I think the government is going to survive on this one. There's been a day of calm. It's very difficult for the opposition to win this battle because the military has stayed true to the government. And not only that, but the Sunni elite and the Sunni imams have been coming out backing the government. Now, you see, you're talking about conversions on the road to Damascus, which is important to understand the Syrian context because the ruling group and the president in Syria are Alawites, which is a minority,
right,
a sectarian minority that traditionally in Islam has been accused of being un-Islamic or kafir. And Syrians are reaching towards some sort of secularism, but they haven't arrived there yet. And people underlying everything in Syria is a sectarianism, a religious tension, because different groups believe the others are godless. And, that seems – it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not unfounded. It's the reason why the Alawites will not relinquish power.
Well, but is it also the reason why a move towards secularism is kind of a peacemaking dynamic in the sense that it gives all of these various groups an equal shot maybe or slightly unequal shot?
Has tried to impose secularism on Syria, but it's been imposed. I mean, there hasn't been a true enlightenment, if you will, through the Middle East because the constitution of Syria – says that the president has to be a Muslim. And most theologically, Muslims do not accept the Alawites as Muslims.
Now, well, and that
legally,
is, that, of course, was the, that was the case in Egypt. The Constitution said the president had to be a Muslim there.
In Egypt, there is a Sunni president, and that's not a problem. It's a problem for the cops,
right,
who are 10%, but they're marginal. The Alawites are running the country. And so this creates a deep-seated tension between the majority and the minority. Now, it's dying out. And, this time around, the religious tension has been kept submerged. And the slogans on both sides have not been overtly sectarian. We've seen them pop out every once in a while. And there was just a demonstration, for example, in Dubai that said, La Iran, La Hezbollah, Badna Qaid, Bechaf Allah. No Iran, no Hezbollah. We want a ruler who fears God.
Interesting. Well, so you're decoding the sort of sectarian subtext of what's going on in Syria. Let's do a couple of sort of broader strokes here before we go. Do you think the nation of Jordan supports tacitly the government in Syria? And if there was a revolution in Damascus, would suddenly Jordan have to show up and change its government as well?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. And I think that the whole foreign policy apparatus of the United States and regionally, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, who have traditionally been anti-Syria because they're the Sunnis, and King of Jordan talked about Syria as part of this Shiite crescent that was sort of lurking there in the Middle East. And on the one hand, I think they would like regime change. On the other hand, as you imply, I think they're very frightened of the implications.
Well, that stalls them out then in trying to push things forward. So let's get back to Damascus then. Does Bashar al-Assad play an Iran card to get out of this mess? If there are calls for Syria to move away from Iran, which, of course, the U.S. would love, is that a way of placating the people in the street by saying, all right, we're going to not support the Hezbollah? We're not going to...
I've heard from the leadership any mention of Iran or Hezbollah or so forth. That's not something he's airing. And in fact, he has he supported Saudi Arabia in their crackdown on Bahrain, a Shiite majority. So in a sense, he's trying to close in with Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the United States. Clinton came out yesterday and said, we're not going to do in Syria what we did in Libya. And said that many people see Bashar al-Assad as a reformer. So I think people are stepping back from the abyss when it comes to Syria.
All right. Then finally, there's a widespread perception in the Middle East, and we've talked with reporters in Bahrain and Beirut and in Jordan, who think that the U.S. is for the status quo in every single one of these conflicts, including Syria. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't think it's that simple. I don't think there's one. You know, America is doing a lot of, they are playing rope-a-dope here, and they're trying to figure out where their interests lie and where their ideological, sort of purity has to part ways with interests. And I think Syria is one of those countries where it can't quite figure out what it needs, because it's very central, very important.
Well, who knew that Tripoli, Libya, was on the road to Damascus? Joshua Landis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Josh Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.